afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. And it is Thursday, July 28th, 2022. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hey, Melody. How the heck are you? Happy National Chili Dog Day. Have you had yours yet?
Not yet.
There's still time.
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Well, I know the place, the best hot dog I ever had in my life, and I can still taste them to this day. And I don't know if they still make them the same way. Well, hot dogs, their ingredients have changed over the years, so probably not. They probably don't taste the same. The William Penn in Lebanon, Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
they used to have the best hot dogs. They had this little chili on top. It was more like hamburger crumble with onions. I don't think it really was a sauce. It was more just like a crumble.
They still make it.
It's but I wonder if it tastes the same.
It's not what it used to be, but, you know, it still brought back good memories.
Yeah.
When I had it just a couple of years ago.
Oh, you did have them a couple of years ago?
I did.
Wow.
Maybe three, four years ago at most.
Wow. Unbelievable.
And I went in for that only reason.
Hot dogs.
The clientele had changed over the years, too.
Well, I can't even imagine. I mean, this place is, I would think it's pretty worn down.
Yeah, it is. If some of the old furnishings, or they had some of the old furnishings.
Wow.
50s, 60s style.
Well, whenever I hear chili dogs, I think of the William Penn.
There you go.
Lebanon, Pennsylvania.
All right. Well,
we celebrate
our memories.
Yes. And whenever I hear the kind of news I heard today, I expect gold to go higher. And it did just a little bit. Nothing to write home about, but we'll take $20 in the New York spot price aftermarket, $1,757. Silver had a nice day, almost 5% at $20.09. Platinum shows flat from yesterday, 897. Palladium was up 47 at 2,157. The USDX today was down 0.20 at 106.25. And, you know, I did see somebody's comments saying that, hey, the U.S. dollar is not strong. And that really is kind of true. I mean, when you look at the dollar only buying, you know, less than a nickel's worth of stuff, then, you know, it's lost a 90%+ of its purchasing power. It shouldn't be defined as a stronger dollar at all. It's a very much a weak dollar. But when you're using the index with the various other currencies and so forth, it is stronger against those other currencies.
Yes.
You know, not for our purchasing power. So we do want to make that clear when we say that we don't really mean. Yeah, we really don't mean that it's a strong dollar. Just crude oil was up 0.16 at 97.10. And let's see, paper markets today. Well, after some little bit of, I can't even imagine what they had to do to get the Dow up over 1% today, 32,529. They were all up over 1% in the paper markets. S&P 4,072, the NASDAQ 130. Well, I guess because after you sign almost $1 trillion infrastructure, well, they call it infrastructure. I call it, it's not infrastructure. It's destructuring our country, taking us down that deep hole of debt because there's no way our government will pay for it through taxes or anything else. It's not beneficial to most of the people of this nation. And again, it's who is it really benefiting? It's not benefiting you and me, folks. So, you know, and again, we'll talk about this here in a little bit. You know, Joe Manchin, for those who thought that, you know, he could be maybe he will be the next presidential candidate. Who knows? Because he had to have been bought off. He didn't do anything for the West Virginia people. Nothing. And so those of you who thought he was a pretty good guy, that he was a little more on the conservative, maybe guess again, folks. Politicians are all the same. They don't change their spots. They are who they are. And so now that I got that off my chest, and I'll probably review that again here in a little bit. So everything was positive in the U.S. markets. Asia, come on, show me what Asia did. Europe, FTSE was the only one that was down. Most of them were all over 1%, except the FTSE. The DAX was not quite 1%. 10-year yield took a tumble, 2.667%. So that's good for mortgages and so forth like that. Especially after the recent increase that we had yesterday, so it doesn't really seem to reflect that. Oil, Brent was higher. Natural gas was lower by 4%, 8.195, and Brent was higher at 107.54. So that is all pretty much the same. So, and you're going to continue to hear this, and people are still going to believe it, that the economy is not in a recession. That's what they tell us. That's what we're supposed to believe. And I just lost all my script, Dave, my notes here. So let me see if I can pull them up here real quick while I'm fumbling. Maybe you can go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can start. I mean, as of 8:30 Eastern time today, the numbers are finally in, and the long wait is over. I mean, to us, the numbers aren't much of a surprise. The economy shrank for the second straight quarter from April to June, hitting the widely, or I should say, a widely accepted rule of thumb for a recession. Now, the numbers come from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, which shows that gross domestic product fell at 0.9% annualized pace for the second quarter. That follows the 1.6 decline in the first quarter and happened to be worse than the consensus estimate for a small gain of 0.3%. I mean, officially, the National Bureau of Economic Research declares recessions and expansions, for that matter, and likely won't make a judgment on where we are right now for several more months, if not longer, which isn't a good thing. But, second straight negative GDP reading meets the long-held fundamental view of what indeed constitutes recessions, despite the unusual circumstances of the decline, and really regardless of what the NBER decides. We know that, pardon me, got a frog in my throat. It must be those numbers, Melody. GDP is the broadest measure of our economy, they say, and encompasses the total level of goods and services produced during the period. You want to take over from there?
Yeah, well, you're going to hear everybody's going to say, hey, we're not in a recession. Well, that's the talking point that they're going to do. But the people out there are still hurting, or we wouldn't be in negative growth. I mean, come on. So it's just stalling, but we're not in a recession. This is what you're going to be hearing, and the decline in GDP came from a broad swath of factors, decreases in inventory, residential, non-residential investment, a little bit in government spending at all levels, gross private domestic investment. Hey, that tumbled 13.5% for the quarter. Consumer spending, hey, that increased a whole 1%, we saw services that accelerated a little bit, but hey, things are off. And the only thing that inventories that helped boost GDP in 2021, they were a drag on growth in the second quarter. They're going to take that and they're going to chop and dice this up to make it come out like it really isn't all that bad, because they need to get through September. And I haven't heard anything about budgets or any. Have you heard about anything like that stuff, Dave?
Appropriation bills, no. They're almost a thing of the past in Washington. One thing I find interesting, one of the numbers, is that personal savings rate was down from 5.6 to 5.2%. Now, that's almost a 10% increase, not quite, 8 or 9. But how can the savings rate go down by that much? And I don't have the dollar figure of what it went down by, but how can that go down? Consumer spending not having increased more. We're going to be talking about the difference, the divergence of gross domestic income and gross domestic product later in the program.
Well, because they're spending it on what doesn't include consumer spending, and they probably do what they do for, you know, the CPI. Well, let's exclude this and that to get this number better. It's a better number, so that's probably how they do it. I don't know if you're going to talk about that in the third segment, but they have their equations to make their numbers sound rosier than what they are. And so we have applications for unemployment insurance fell for the first time in 4 weeks, but still held near the highest level since November. So initial unemployment claims, 256,000 in the week ending July 3rd. Everybody was kind of estimating 250,000 estimates. So I don't know. It seems like it's more than they were expecting. Continuing claims for state benefits fell to 1.36 million in the week ending July 16th. And that's about it on that one, Dave. What would you like to add?
Well, we have Bloomberg economist Eliza Winger, who said that if the gradual increase in layoffs keeps up, and they're up 90,000 from mid-March, then initial claims would reach typically recessionary levels by the end of next January. The labor market remains tight at the moment and is able to absorb layoff workers. I think on the one hand, she's typical, like most mainstream economists, who are giving themselves some future credit should a recession in this case be declared, but then giving herself an out by couching it with this tight labor market. So it's on the one hand, on the other, where do they actually stand?
Well, they don't, and that's the problem. They don't stand at all, and it's they got to make it cheery, rosy, and you know, because they don't want to panic the people. And they don't want people selling their investments. They don't want people to. They want people to continue to consume, you know, and that's what you hear. Get out there and spend. Get out there and spend. Continue to consume because you're the economy. Doesn't matter if you go into debt. Doesn't matter if you have difficult times paying your bills. Go out and buy. And it's really a sad commentary for this nation.
Yeah, in terms of the trend line, too, I mean, this four-week moving average of jobless claims, which tries to smooth out the week-to-week volatility, is now up to just under 250,000. And it's risen in 15 of the last 16 weeks. So that tells you that it's been going on for a good 4 months where – essentially, there are more and more people being laid off. So this shouldn't come as a surprise whatsoever to those of us who believe that the R word is among us as we speak.
And you know what? The funny thing is, Dave, our purchasing power has declined so much. I mean, we could have you know, the definition that we've always followed was two negative quarters. I mean, that doesn't have to happen. But when you look at our purchasing power, I think we're in a continued recession. Because with the inflation that we've had built in, inflation doesn't come and go. It's been here. It increases. And it can soften, but it's here. It takes away our purchasing power on a daily basis. So basically, we're always in a recession. We've never really, do we ever really come out of one with that type of a decline in our purchasing power from our dollar? You know, so, and again, your wages are up. What example did I hear this morning? Wages are up 6%. Inflation is up 9%. So you lose 6%. I don't know. Anyway, mortgage rates now with a little bit of pressure taken off those rates. We've seen the 30-year rate fall back a little bit, 5.3%. It was just a little bit higher last week. But still, a year ago, it was 2.8. And even that 5.3%, 5.54% from last week did make a difference, does make a difference on higher valued homes. If you look to the 15-year rate, you get a little bit of a break, 4.58%, and that's down a little bit. But a year ago, 2.1%. So that was a deal for higher value homes for 15 years. And so everybody knows by now the Fed has raised their 0.75 points. So, you know, we continue to see and, you know, they think that they're going to get back to their 2% annual target. Well, they'll get back to it. They'll do it the same way they've always done it, by lies and misinformation, Dave.
Well, we know that sales of existing homes are down for the fifth consecutive month. Mortgage applications now have declined overall 18% from last year. Mm-hmm. Refinancing actually down 83% to a two-decade low. And layoffs in these sectors, the housing and lending sectors, have already begun. You're talking about Loan Depot or Redfin and Compass. But the nation's largest bank, too big to fail and five-time felon J.P. Morgan Chase, yay, has laid off hundreds from its mortgage unit and reassigned hundreds of others to jobs elsewhere in that company. So things are getting rotten in Denmark in more ways than one.
And, you know, when you see these, you know, the GDP, two negative quarters, that's really just the beginning. You know, I think everything follows after that. And we're going to follow after this breaks. So please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csetalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. We do have some 90%. I broke them up into little bags of silver, 90%. We actually have some 50-cent pieces, too. Now, they're still a little bit more expensive, and we have a very limited supply based on these prices, and I'm not going to give the prices over the phone or over the radio. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188, and we'll be closing at 5 o'clock this evening, so do it here in the next few minutes, and I'll give you a call as soon as I'm finished with the program. So 1-800-375-4188. And again, you know, we talked about the Fed being between a rock and a hard place. We see growth is beginning to sputter. These home sales are tumbling. Recession talk. Consumers barely spending. But, hey, we're consumers, and that's we do what we're supposed to do. And so prices are soaring, and you have the Fed that's trying to douse this inflation with interest rate hikes, but it's just going to make it more and more expensive for households and businesses. So they're trying to pull off a triple axle of central banking, slow the economy just enough to curb inflation without causing a recession. But the recession has already been caused. Inflation is not curbing except by their temporary little fixes that they think is a good thing. So it's they can't do it. And that's why it's called between a rock and a hard place. They can't do it, Dave.
Well, you're in good company, Melody. There are a lot of other people who follow this stuff in the financial markets every day who doubt the Fed can manage that feat. I'm sure if Scotty Hamilton were an economist, he'd be bumming right now at the poor quality of the triple axle that the Fed's attempting. But I mean, look, high inflation's most often the side effect of a hot economy. In fact, you know, inflation per se is with us each and every day. I mean, the value of the U.S. dollars declined over 97% since the mid 1800s. It's not the current slow pace of growth. And again, we're flashing back to the 1970s when this scorching inflation coexisted with slow growth. You know, it hatched that new ugly S word, stagflation. Now, the U.S. isn't quite there yet. But give us another quarter, particularly If the Fed follows through with three or four more rate hikes by the end of this year, could very well be, look, I'm sure the Treasury and Fed officials, among other government officials, the White House Council of Economic Advisors, are going to do whatever they can to say, inflation's still higher than 2%, whatever it is, and we're seeing the third or fourth straight quarter of negative growth, but that's not stagflation. It's got to be deeper, It's got to be 5 or 6% negative growth, not just 1, 2, or 3. Whatever it is, and however you want to define it. The curious thing is, and this is what I think we really, if there's one factor to watch, and certainly there are a lot of them, but I think the most important factor is the job market and consumer spending, because that accounts for 70% of GDP. But this bizarre job market, which, on the one hand, again, next Friday we'll get the latest jobs report. Is that going to be 300,000, 400,000, 500,000, or is it going to be 100,000 or 200,000 or less? That'd be a really big indicator, I think, of where we are. So in the meantime, Fed economic forecasters are stuck in this uncharted territory. And then the Fed's catching up, and all we're left to do is worry, will they overreact and make it worse? Melody.
Well, I think the state of what we're in and everything that they're doing, they talk from both sides, talking about, we're going to control the inflation and everything. But and then on the other side, they do everything to increase it. So, when you're spending trillions of dollars, that's going to come into this country, into this economy, from anywhere from the student loan forgiveness to giving. I mean, they're just giving everything away to people. And that's going to make inflation higher. So it doesn't matter what the Fed does. I don't care if they raise it and they try to adjust it and everybody is fully employed and so forth. The other side is they're creating the inflation, and that's not going to go away. So people can't buy. They can't afford the things. Trying to bring things, it's just bizarre. So everything that they're doing isn't really even going to work. And that's what is so baffling, how these people, these politicians, can get on board and just go along and clap hands and think this is a great idea, and all along they're just selling out the American people, because it isn't going to help them at all. And it's not a matter of maybe helping.
Look, some of it helps.
No, it doesn't.
Yes, it
temporarily
does.
Maybe, and for who? And the taxpayer has to, and those who do pay taxes get to pick up the tab. Now, how fair is that?
And some of these things. I don't mind if a billionaire has to pay a little bit more so that.
But they're the ones who don't pay. But they're the ones who don't pay.
Yeah.
It's the middle class that pays. Always has, always will. And that's not going to change. So, and they talk about, it'll benefit in 15 or 20 years. Well, what about today? What can we do today? And giving things away for free isn't going to work. And so, because it puts us right back. So they're not addressing the problems. They're only creating new ones. And that's the frustrating part. Here you have North Korean dictator Mr. Kim Jong-un. Again, he's warning he's ready to use nuclear weapons. And potential military conflicts with the U.S. and South Korea. He's made those threats before. But he had a speech to war veterans on the 69th anniversary of the end of the Korean War. It was apparently meant to boost internal unity. And observers say while Kim has increasingly threatened his rivals with nuclear weapons, it's unlikely that he would use them first against the superior militaries of the U.S. and its allies. Well, it depends. You got Russia there and you got China there. So he's not alone anymore. I mean, we go begging to Iran for oil, so he's not alone anymore. So Kim also alleged the new South Korean government of President Yol is led by confrontation maniacs and gangsters who have gone further than other previous South Korean conservative governments, Dave.
Yeah, he his choice of words is, shall we say, not conducive to good diplomatic relations. He refers to the new South Korean government of President Yoon Suk-yeol as being led by confrontation maniacs and gangsters. Since taking office in May, the Yoon government has moved to strengthen Seoul's military alliance with the U.S. and beef up its own capacity to neutralize these nuclear threats, including a preemptive strike capability. But Kim said, talking about military action against our nation, which possesses absolute weapons that they fear the most, is preposterous and is very dangerous suicidal action. It doesn't bode well for getting the North to return to the table to talk anytime soon about denuclearization, Melody.
No, but you know what? He's going to become a little more emboldened by what's going on with China. And here you have Biden and Xi Jinping. They're supposed to have it where they, I guess they did have a conversation today.
Yes.
They spoke for more than 2 hours charting the future. You know, and it all came back. It really started to, it got hot. I don't know if they'd have this conversation if it wasn't all over Pelosi's planned trip to Taiwan and China coming out and saying, well, you know, she better not because we're going to do this and that if she does. Well, this is, I mean, I'm not a fan of her going there. But on the other hand, China telling us what we can and can't do. I don't know, Dave. It's kind of, that's kind of scary when you think about it. And,
yeah, I mean, it potentially, it's certainly hard to know if this is just diplomatic bluster, posturing to your own internal, stakeholders. By Xi and by his spokespeople, you know, who talk about, you know, if the U.S. insists on going its own way and challenging China's, it will surely be met with forceful responses. Biden has said recently it's not a good idea for Pelosi to travel there, apparently based on some conversation with State and Defense Department officials. But hopefully that wasn't all they talked about. Certainly other issues. But, I mean, we've talked for 2 years at least now about growing tensions in the South China Sea, where, you know, each other's jets flow by the other's naval ships out there. And, you know, every now and then they'll be a spokesperson for both sides that warned the other. And it still would be incredibly expensive. I think it's not a good time for Xi to be considering any kind of invasion, if you will, or takeover of Taiwan. Now, some think that, well, with all the focus on Russia and Ukraine, that, you know, it is indeed a good time for him to even, you know, further mess up the geopolitical scene. But, you know, there's still China's on its way to becoming the number one economy in the world, yes. Whether it happens by 2030, 40, or 50. It's probably going to be sooner than later, just by its sheer size, and the fact that it manufactures a lot of its
what we
own
gave
items
up,
that are
what
exported.
We gave them.
Yes.
And what we gave them.
So, you know, there was this one thing that, you know, Biden trying to encourage other democracies around the world to support new infrastructure investments in the poorer nations as an alternative to China's Belt and Road Initiative. And that'll be interesting to see, especially as we talk about Russia's attempting to further influence or vie for influence in Africa, if that'll have any impact.
Yeah, maybe they should, instead of trying to support infrastructure investments in low and middle income nations, maybe these other global countries should invest in their own countries. But that ain't going to happen. Anyway, Russia, yeah.
Colonialism
you know what,
lives,
China?
I'm afraid.
Huh?
Colonialism is alive and well, I'm afraid.
You know, the influence in Africa has really been going on. China's been in there for, what, the past 10 years, 8 years, something like that, Dave? Moving slowly in. And now you have Russian, French, and American leaders. They're kind of crisscrossing Africa to win support just for their positions on the war in Ukraine. So you have Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and French President Macron. They're visiting several African countries this week. Samantha Power, who heads the U.S. Agency for International Development, went to Kenya and Somalia last week. The U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Linda Thomas Greenfield, they're going to go to a couple places next week. So is there a Cold War kind of playing out in Africa? Where the rival sides are trying to gain influence or maybe just take their their land away instead of letting Africa have earn their own money, and they're in there to take their their minerals there. What am I trying to think of there? Because they're very rich in various what are they called, Dave?
What? Blood diamonds?
No. Not precious metals, but the minerals, the rare earth.
Yes.
The rare earths. So that's what they're in there for. Take it away from Africa so these other countries can get in there. And that's how I see it, Dave. I don't know. How do you see it?
See it that we'll just have to wait until we get back from this next break.
Okay. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSCTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Okay, one more time today. Welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody taking care of other client business. This final segment, call her 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver needs. Well, here's another story to get your blood roiling. For more than a decade, too big to fail, U.S. Bank pressured its employees to open fake accounts. Lots and lots of fake accounts in their customers' names to meet unrealistic sales goals. It's according to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, came out with a report today. It's a case that's deeply similar to the sales practices scandal uncovered at Wall Street Reject Wells Fargo Bank a couple years ago. CFPB alleged that similar to Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank accessed consumer credit reports to open checking and savings accounts, credit cards, lines of credit without their permission. Employees were encouraged to do so. Probably the better word there was pressured, to meet the bank's goal of selling multiple products to each customer with the bank. The scale of U.S. Bank's fake accounts scandal wasn't disclosed immediately by the CFPB, but the bank was forced to pay $37.5 million in fines and penalties and will have to refund customers any fees they were charged for the fake accounts. CFPB Director Rohit Chopra said, for over a decade, U.S. Bank knew its employees were taking advantage of its customers by misappropriating consumer data to create fictitious amounts. I mean, if in fact the practice had been going on for 10 years, it's amazing, in my humble opinion, how no one discovered it before then. Spokesperson for U.S. Bank said the bad sales practices were a legacy issue at the bank dating back to 2016, and that the bank has since made significant improvements to those sales practices. Now, the consent order reached with the CFPB acknowledges that U.S. Bank did make improvements to those practices in recent years. Lee Henderson of the bank says the action by the CFPB closes out more than a five-year investigation, and we're pleased to have this matter put behind us. Too big to fail, Wells Fargo sales practice scandal rocked the financial world 5 years ago when, maybe it was six, when the bank was found to have encouraged employees to open millions of fake accounts to meet sales goals there. Scandal ruined Wells Fargo's reputation as a well-run bank through the Great Recession, and led to billions of dollars worth of fines against the bank, and also to the resignation of the bank's CEO and eventually its board of directors. Wells has been under tight supervision by the Fed since that scandal, keeping the bank from growing any bigger until it fixes its workplace culture. In fact, there are no signs that the Fed is planning to release Wells from its regulatory leash anytime soon. Let's get back to the economy. Consumers are still increasing their spending, though at a slower pace.
But underneath the hood, a necessary rotation is underway. The economy is exiting this pandemic era phase where consumers spent big on goods and less on services. And the rotation, economists say, is a welcome development, though it's caught many businesses off guard. Retailers have been stocking up on inventory to meet a level of demand that hasn't come close to being materialized, and goods consumption in the second quarter pulled down overall growth by over 1 percentage point. Services spending, however, added 1.8 percentage points. Adjusted for inflation, spending on healthcare and restaurants rose double digits compared to the prior to the first quarter. Now, on the good side, the spending on recreational goods and vehicles dropped 10% from the first quarter. And so there are plenty of anecdotes about consumers slowing their spending on big ticket items they indulged in early in the pandemic. One of the latest signs comes from electronics retailer Best Buy, which says shoppers pulled back on purchases like televisions at a faster and deeper pace than expected in the second quarter. What's unclear, the big picture, is how shortages like this are still figuring into the spending slowdown. I mean, after all, consumers can't buy what isn't available. Now, this next one may sound like an obscure, simply technical step involving the management of America's strategic oil reserve. But some are saying that an action announced by the Biden administration yesterday could have lasting positive impact for energy supplies here. White House announced a plan whereby the Energy Department could enter into contracts to replenish the strategic petroleum reserve in the future at prices set today. Energy companies have been reluctant to invest in more production despite today's high sky prices, because they think prices will come down in the future. They have been inching down, at least domestically. The new policy is a gambit to use executive authority to increase energy supply, but while holding prices down today. U.S. oil reserve, the strategic petroleum reserve, exists to allow the government to temporarily bring in extra oil to market when supplies are short. It's an action the administration took following Putin's invasion of Ukraine. But traditionally, the government's replenished the reserve at whatever prices were at the time of purchase. The Energy Department proposed rules this week that would allow it to enter long-term contracts to restock it at a price fixed in advance. And that's the crux. The White House says fixed-price contracts can give producers the assurance to make investments today, adding it would encourage near-term production, promote market stability, and put the government in a better position to respond to future market volatility. Well, we shall see. What's next? You know, as if the economy wasn't already confusing enough, an unprecedented gap between two crucial yardsticks that I referred to in the last segment of growth tells a different story. Gross domestic product gets the most headlines and currently says the economy shrank in the first half of the year by a cumulative 2.5%, 1.6 in the first, followed by 0.9. Last quarter. Now, I say currently because GDP figures are revised monthly almost ad infinitum. The other metric, gross domestic income, GDI, says the economy actually grew, you know, at least in the first quarter. Problem came to a head today, especially as GDP turned out to show contraction for a second straight quarter. That will surely heighten the we are, we aren't in a recession debate. But with continuing robust job creation that we talked about, economists aren't even sure if the activity was as weak as first quarter data suggest. And here's how it works. I mean, as we know, GDP adds up all the spending in the economy on goods and services. Individuals, business, local, state, federal governments. The GDI sums up income, wages, business profits, or interest payments, as the name suggests. Now, in theory, the two measures should be equal. I mean, after all, what one person spends is another person's income, right? But in practice, the different data sources mean they can diverge or even be at odds with one another. And right now, the gap between the two has never been wider, with GDI at $20.4 trillion and GDP at $19.7. Economist Vince Reinhardt at Dreyfus and Mellon says GDI squares better with some parts of activity that we know. It's hard to understand how we could be adding close to 400,000 workers each month on payrolls and then not be producing more stuff. Inflation-adjusted GDI has outpaced that of GDP since the end of 2020, however. On an annualized basis, the divergence hit a record $676 billion. As of the end of the first quarter. And that's the difference between the two numbers I just mentioned. The end result is two pictures of the economy's health. GDI rose at a 1.8% annualized pace, while GDP fell at a 1.6% annualized pace. That's in the first quarter. Future revisions, which continue up to years after these data are first released, may eventually bring the two gauges back in step together, but for now, the Biden administration, anyway, expects the divergence to continue. Treasury officials say this year's first quarter growth was likely favorable when looking at income, employment, and overall production. Looking forward, initial reads on the income data suggest this growth continued into the second quarter. So which measure should get more weight, more attention, more interest by us? Well, the unsatisfying answer is probably both. Economists, like those at the National Bureau of Economic Research, the arbiter of official recessions, actually like to look at an average of the two. It's an interesting thought. Research by former Fed economist Jeremy Nailwake found that since the 1990s, initial GDI growth estimates tend to predict eventual revisions to GDP. So we'll have to take a closer look at that down the road. But now that we know the second quarter's GDP number, we're going to have to wait until next month for its sister metric GDI to be released. Now, Neil Irwin and Courtney Brown write today for Axios that there's not much left to say in the semantic debate over whether the U.S.'s two straight quarters of GDP contraction means we're in a recession. Again, the Committee of Economists and at the NBER that arbitrate these things probably won't see it that way, but two quarters, and Jay Powell and today Janet Yellen and Joe Biden says we're not in a recession, but two quarters of contraction is indeed a common rule of thumb for a recession. So you can decide for yourself which definition you embrace. More important than the actual definition of recession is what today's new data tell us about how the economy is evolving. On that front, Irwin and Brown believe the details of the GDP report are pretty gory. Consumers aren't ramping up their spending like they had been. Businesses are taking a pause on investment, and housing is beginning to slump big time. That, they say, is a recipe for a serious downturn in the second half of the year, whatever terminology we use. And while the headline GDP number for the second quarter showed a 0.9% contraction, the underlying details are worse in terms of what they imply for the future. The biggest drag in the second quarter was a decline in inventories, but that's also the easiest to ignore because those numbers swing around in ways that don't tend to say much about the future. If we focus on the indicators of underlying domestic demand for signals of where things are going, there's clearly softening across the board. Final sales to private domestic purchasers flatlined, actually shrank to 0.01%. From 2010 to 2019, years we think of as steady expansion, that number averaged an annualized 2.8% a quarter and never fell below about roughly 0.8%. Business spending on structures and equipment also fell, subtracting a combined 0.5 percentage point from overall GDP growth, and that was their steepest decline since the pandemic began. Meanwhile, residential investments subtracted 0.7 percentage point, also falling the most since the start of the pandemic. Notably, Irwin and Brown point out, these drops in business investment in housing cover the second quarter. But many signs point to distress in those sectors, spreading further in the second half of the year. The volatility in those segments of the economy may have only just begun. Meanwhile, personal consumption spending continues to grow, but only contributed 0.7 percentage point to GDP growth in the second quarter. That's the lowest since the start of the pandemic. Meanwhile, personal consumption spending continued to grow in Q2, but only, 0.7. I just said that. Sorry. Thanks to high inflation, we're not rushing to spend at high enough rates to keep the overall economy and afloat. So whatever you call it, a recession, a soft patch, a hard landing, the underlying momentum in the economy is clearly fading. And you know, thanks largely to the Fed and rising corporate greed, it's likely to get worse before it gets better. That's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday. Melody, back tomorrow with Butch. Also, be on the lookout for our weekly blog in your email inboxes in the morning. Thanks, as always, to our engineer Todd, and to you for tuning in, Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.